Yeah, if you have your mics open, if you can mute them, that would be appreciated unless we're talking. I just want to call the meeting to order at 6:02, the special meeting of the board. The primary purpose of the meeting was to go over the year-end audit for the school, which needs to be submitted by the end of September. So we're going to do that, but I think the auditors are coming on a little bit later, so we added a few other items to the agenda to include some updates on potential reopening plans, as well as the new updated budget numbers that we have for the current fiscal year. So as part of that, why don't we start off the meeting with the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Just pulling out, so we had to move the, like I said, we had to move the agenda around a little bit. We will start off with, I don't know if we have any public comments at this time. If not, we can move them to the end of the hour. But if anybody wants to ask any questions, they can put them into the chat, and we can take them on a first-come, first-served basis. I'll let folks sit for a minute. If we don't get any, we can go through the budget information and the reopening plans that the administration has, and then we can take some questions at that point. Ricardo, do we have a time when the auditors will be dialing in? Or we're going over the audit data?
I believe they should be dialing in around 7:30, potentially, if not a little bit sooner than that.
Okay.
Elias, do you want to finalize?
I missed that.
Do you want to see who's taking down minutes for this meeting?
Yeah. Is Ken on? I texted Ken. Are you going to be able to take minutes, Ken? Or I think...
Is Ken on?
And he's out of town, so probably he can't.
He's actually calling.
On the phone. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Ken.
It's muffled.
Okay. Yeah, sorry, I'm in a data center. I will listen, and from the recording, I will make minutes. So everybody will just need to say their name when they do so.
Do you want, if it's too hard for you to track the minutes, Marianne, would you be able to do it, or?
Yeah, I can do it this time, Ken, if you need me to.
Okay.
Okay. If you don't mind, I'm stuck in Tulsa, Oklahoma for an extra night.
It's okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, I'll mute.
Sorry.
And decide when do you rebut the lie. You can't leave it unanswered, but when do you say, wait a minute, you gotta hear it.
What are you doing now?
All right, so I'm not seeing any comments. So if anybody wants to put some questions into the comments section over the next hour or so, once we're done, before the audit, because the audit will go on for about an hour, 45 minutes afterwards. Prior to the audit, we'll take some questions if there's some time. So I guess the first order of business, do you have any?
For the school.
You have, you want to give an overview? I guess we'll go over the budget first. The updated budget for 21.
Sure. Yeah, this is Karen. I'll take that, and I do have a PowerPoint we can put up so people can follow along. Okay. So if you recall, back in July, the board had approved a preliminary budget, but at that time we indicated that we would be coming back with an updated preliminary budget for board approval. So I'll run through the basic changes that have been made. The enrollment in the budget that was previously approved, we had estimated at 1950, and we are now doing the updated budget at 1930 students, so a decrease of 20 students. State operations are based on the FY 2021 budget bill, step increase, no state salary increase. That is the same as the preliminary budget, but the state revenues have gone down because of the decrease in students. local district transfers, for a couple of months, we were talking about the potential decrease in local per pupil amounts coming from the districts. I believe Jeff had already mentioned at the last meeting that the news that came through was only three of the four main districts that Odyssey pulls from actually had increases, and only one had a decrease. There are also a couple of additional COVID revenue sources that had not been included before. There's an additional 88,000 of COVID education revenue available, and Newcastle County has also put out a distance learning grant of 95,000, and Jeff has done the applications on those already. This version of the budget includes 400,000 being released from the investors, and those funds have already been received. And we are also projecting a draw of 246,000 from the repair and replacement fund based on expenses for those items that are included in the budget that we're going to review. Cafeteria revenue has been adjusted to reflect changes in how meals are being served between now and the opening, full opening of school, and also to accommodate academia upon their reopening. And aftercare revenue has been reduced to deliver services for just the second half of the school year. A couple things that we had mentioned last time also before we get to expenditures, we do have in rent for our tenants in the two buildings that are occupied. We do not have any fundraising or donations in this version of the budget, so anything that might occur in that area could be an increase to revenues for the year. Moving into expenditures, there were some staffing changes made. In the original version of the budget, we had added one special ed teacher, and through attrition, three positions have been eliminated, so this budget reflects that net impact of two less staff members. The salary information is the same as the last version, where there, as I said earlier, the state had an increase in step, but no increase in the scale, and the local salary scales are based on the bargaining agreement and other salary scales that the school has in place. We have moved the head of school salary to November. We had that in a little earlier in the year. Other employment costs are calculated the same as the last time. There was a slight decrease in the pension rate compared to last year. And we are including capital cost of $430,000 for the new classrooms in Building 23, most of that being covered by the $400,000 coming in from the investors. And the debt service, oh, there's also some technology and furniture costs associated on top of that $430,000. And the debt service includes a payment of $38,103. It actually shows under building improvements, but it's part of the debt service payment. So each division budget has been vetted and adjusted since the last version of the preliminary budget. As I mentioned, food service, the revenue is adjusted. The expenses are also adjusted for the changes in how meals are being delivered. Under facilities, we had already added one custodian. We have capital projects of $270,000 deferred to next year. That is a bit less than the last version. IT expenditures have been adjusted to reflect costs that are being funded by COVID and the Newcastle County grant. So there is an increase to expenditures, but there's also an increase to revenue for those items. And transportation at this point does not include adding any buses for this year. And the athletics coaching staff expense has been reduced by 10%, depending on how sports end up being delivered this year. That may go down further. So it's just some general comments on this version of the budget. The one thing we have not accounted for that is still an unknown is what will be any additional costs when school actually does reopen fully for in-person learning. What additional barriers, protective devices, or other costs that may come in at that point in time, and whether or not there may be some other funds to cover them. So at this point, with the changes that I outlined, the ending cash balance is projected to be $3,670,000, and that represents deficit spending of $691,000. The last version of the budget had $3.2 million as the ending cash balance and a deficit spending of over $1 million. I know Ricardo's been taking a look at how this version of the budget is impacting the investor covenant. So, Ricardo, I'll let you make a couple of comments.
It's not a flat room either. I mean, there's nowhere left to hide. I'm worried.
On that item.
Okay, thank you, Karen. Good evening. Everybody knows there's three covenants that we measure. Basically, debt coverage ratio, days of cash on hand, and then a fund balance covenant. With the updates that are being presented at this point in time, we're looking at a debt coverage ratio of 113 versus a coverage requirement of 110. So it is, even with all these adjustments, it is very, very tight. And of course, we'll talk a little, Karen, I don't know if we're going to also allude to that, there are, this does not contemplate any additional costs that we may reincur as part of a reopening strategy while we're still in a COVID-19, in a COVID environment. The days of cash on hand, the target is 60 days, and that is a fixed target going on out. At this point in time, we're projecting 50 days with the proposed budget. And then, the fund balance covenant, we're looking at this point in time, $1.817 million. So these are the investor metrics based on, of course, the cash management projections, because we do not have the system to do accrual accounting. So this is on the, this is how we have been reporting to our investors our performance vis-a-vis the committed metrics.
Ricardo, can you go through real quick the last covenant again? I think I missed that. Sorry. After the 50 days.
Yeah, the 50 days against a days of cash on hand, the goal is 60. And then there's a fund balance. The fund balance covenant requires us to have a target of 1.8. Our numbers are coming in ahead of that if we think about 3.6 million, et cetera. So we're running running ahead of that, but understanding that this is strictly on a cash basis, numbers that would come out reported annually as a result of our audit will look different because those are on a modified accrual basis. Karen?
Okay, thank you. So that's an overview of where we are now. Obviously, a lot of changes in revenue and pluses and minuses, a lot of changes in expenses the same way, some increases, some decreases, but overall an increase in the projected year-end cash. But as Ricardo and I both mentioned, this budget is going to be evolving through the year as different situations may arise or changes in how and when school opens. But this is the best version that we can put together at this point in time. And we always have changes between now and December or January anyway. This year is just a little more, has a little more potential for ups and downs as we go through the next few months. But I'll open it up for any questions that the board may have.
What do you think are the major levers that could move up or down as we consider reopening? Can you just talk about the line items and directionally and from a materiality standpoint, best guess how you think it might turn out if we were able to proceed with some sort of reopening sooner rather than later?
Yeah, there are always a couple of items that change anyway, regardless of COVID, in that the school or the state revenue for the school is still evolving. New teachers are being credentialed and things like that. I don't think it's going to be as much of an increase as it may have been in previous years because you didn't have a big change in staff this year, but there is potential for some change from state revenue. On the expense side, let me also back up a little bit. On cafeteria, on the food service budget, we had to make our best estimates at how many meals are going to be served during this COVID shutdown. And then even when school would reopen fully, how many students are still going to be coming into school and taking meals. So there's still potential for changes in the food service portion of the budget. Again, that's probably on both the revenue and expense side. So hopefully the bottom line won't be adjusted that much. And then on the expenditure side, it's mostly the unknowns, the things that we can't quantify at this point. When you would begin delivering transportation services, how many students are going to ride the bus? How many buses will you need to accommodate and whether you'll have to put up protective barriers? Same thing in the classrooms. If the protocols stay the way they are now, you can only have around, 8 to 10 students in a room. And again, are you going to have to put up protective barriers of some sort? And I think we've all heard things about how plexiglass is becoming a little hard to obtain. So those are the kind of costs that that we'll have to keep our eye on and that we just really can't quantify now. I don't know if Jeff or Ricardo, you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would say that facilities and transportation were kind of the bigger unknowns. And, to add to facilities, the costs of the additional cleaning that would need to take place during the day and to the effect of how many buildings we have open and all of that, I think it is kind of what we'll be parsing through as we get closer to that point.
Got it. Thanks for the additional detail.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Just something that's closely in line to the reopening and the costs associated with that. So I know that John had kind of put together some numbers previously related to reopening and costs associated with reopening related to cleaning, like you mentioned, cleaning, HVAC systems and other things. So have we kind of, as we start to look at possible opening scenarios, are we also considering the costs associated with each of those, whether it's small group reopenings or spec ed kids, and what we need to do with respect to cleaning and transportation, and as well as if we start to move to larger scale reopenings, how that cost impacts us. And then there are thresholds where we can sustain so many students, let's say, on buses. And after that, if we need to hire more buses, you know, what are the numbers where if we go over certain thresholds, it may cost us more in transportation, for example. Are we kind of tracking that in any way so we can have an idea as to how that will impact any potential reopening?
Tracking it is difficult right now because you don't know how many students are going to opt in the different areas. And I know that's something that everybody is working on, reaching out to families and seeing who's going to do in person, who may not, who will take the bus, who will not. But each division that you mentioned is positioned to work with that data as more of it becomes available. I know, you know, like you mentioned, you know, John and Evan in transportation under Ricardo's leadership, they're definitely aware of the different issues that are going to arise and what the school's capabilities are at this point. Ricardo, you want to say anything about that?
I was just going to add as well the operations subgroup for the from the reopening committee. I think, like you said, Elias put together some sort of ballpark estimates with that. I think what we don't know is what potential additional resources may be made available for us for some of those. I think we know, you know, the state has mentioned, you know, possibly being able to provide additional day porters, one or two, for the buildings that may be required. So I think we'll just continue to work closely with that subgroup as we get a little bit closer for that.
Yeah. And I think part of the challenge in this process is that we don't know what the trends are. I mean, we have transportation models that says you can carry only 12 students or you might carry 23 students depending on the social distancing requirements on a bus. Depending on how trends go, those numbers can significantly impact. So yes, the subcommittee that is involved in making sure, you know, the operations, you know, and services efforts to see exactly, to respond to the planning and to be able to then quantify the needs, you know, from a financial perspective to render the services. But it's correct. We may have parents that might decide not to bring, you know, not to send their kids by bus, reducing the bus, you know, the bus cost, but they'll come by car. And so the traffic on campus and managing the traffic on campus is going to be a totally different equation, albeit it might not have a cost financially for us from a bus perspective, but it might impact potentially the school schedules, depending on the volume. So we have a lot of moving parts here that intertwine as we, you know, as we move along towards reopening in a landscape that is highly uncertain with regards to what's going to happen this fall and this winter with COVID-19.
Ricardo, who's making the final decision on an issue like that? How many students per bus? Is it the CDC or the DOE? Or do they give us a range and we decide?
It's not from the DOE. Yes, it's primarily from the DOE, the guidance, 3 feet, 6 feet, separation. But as usual, it tends to be guidance. It's not mandated. And then we have to, you know, make our own decisions.
Can you remind me, in terms of the reporting cadence related to our compliance with the bond covenants, is that an annual rep or a monthly? I just can't remember how frequently we report those measurements to the investors or bondholders.
It's annual.
Okay, got it. And that's, is that end of fiscal year or what's the calendar date?
Yes, it's okay. It's our school fiscal year.
So we
get our annual audit, and then we send it out to the investors. We send it out to WSFS because we have a mortgage with them, and then it's the DOE that does the calculations, so that all the schools. We're not subject to a bank calculation. The bank does its own calculations, for example. But the DOE then issues the financial framework, which is consistent across all the schools.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, then if the board would consider approving the budget as it's been presented.
Okay, thank you. We need a motion to approve the budget as presented.
Can I have the ranch? This is Aaron. I'll move to approve the budget as presented.
I'll second it.
Mary Ann seconding. Do we have any discussion on it? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, so the motion carries unanimously. Thank you all. Thank you, Karen and Jeff and Ricardo for that.
Can I have the stick sets? Can anyone who's not on the board or presenting please mute? It's kind of hard. We can meet you one-on-one, but it's hard to figure out whose phone numbers belong to board members and others. So if you could just mute yourself, that would be great.
Thank you. Okay, so next up, we had on the agenda some high-level plans for what a reopening for school and sports might look like. Ricardo, do you want to walk us through those are the thoughts that you had?
Yes, and what I would like to propose here is that maybe as per the proposed agenda, why don't we extricate the fall sport discussion from the reopening update? There are a couple of slides that thread through it in the reopening update, but I think we can have a broader discussion now around that. And we have been working closely, and Matt, a lot of kudos to him because he's been very, very involved with all the other athletic directors, with the DIAA, attending all the meetings, working closely with our school deans in terms of fleshing out what a proposed schedule or sports activities plan might look like. We just recently did a survey of parents, and we have a slide in the deck, I'm just trying to pull it up just as a reference here. Bear with me a minute. Just to launch it, and then I will, we'll pass the baton on to Matt Lauderman, who's really been championing this on behalf of the school. But we, at this point in time, are looking at cross country, volleyball, and soccer. We've done surveys in terms of coaches to see their availability to come back, and started pressure testing with our families in terms of their interest in the specific sports. There were certain numbers that were presented in the deck that we issued earlier this week to you, and I would like to pass it on to Matt at this point in time so that he can start by updating what the surveys are telling us as of today. Matt?
Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much, Ricardo, and Ashley and Brittany. We've been spending a lot of time here together recently going over the different numbers and the different data. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, so like I said, Ricardo, Ashley, Brittany, big thank you to you guys. We've been spending a lot of time here the past couple of weeks, have Ricardo on speed dial just about every day here. But we did send out a survey, the DIA and the DOE reversed course about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago now, with fall sports, saying that we could start them now on September 28th. So some schools in the state started sports yesterday. Others are waiting for approval from their boards and what they want to do. So our proposal is to offer soccer, volleyball, it would be boys soccer, girls volleyball, and then cross country, which is a co-ed sport here for the fall. The numbers that came in were a little bit concerning. As you know, we're a smaller high school than a majority of the schools in the state here. Current numbers as of this evening, Ms. Lipson sent out a reminder for the survey today. So our numbers increased a little bit, but as of right now, we have 12 boys interested in soccer. We have 16 girls interested in playing volleyball. So those numbers are good there. And then we have 10 cross country runners at the moment, six of which are male and four of which are female. So based off those numbers there, I'm confident we could field a volleyball team, but soccer is played 11 on 11 with only 12 on a team. And that's if everybody shows up. Without any injuries, you know, kids getting sick and things like that, that's going to be a very tight number to make work. With cross country in the state of Delaware for scoring, you need five boys and five girls competing in a race. Typically, the top five runners score for you, so we'll have a lot of trouble there with cross country as well. There's going to be a lot of safety protocols in place if we do decide to move forward with sports. Masks are going to be required at all times for all players. This is during practices, during games, coaches as well. Temperature checks, those will be required for all students. The coaches would administer them, and then we would save that data. And then there would be a questionnaire that all students would need to complete by 1 p.m. On days that there are practices or games. What I would like to see happen is, you know, because it's going to be tough to have competitive sports programs with the numbers that we have, you know, at least offer sports to an extent. I've talked with my coaches. They're comfortable to work with the students so we can still do conditioning work, skill-specific work for their sports. And, you know, we can look for scrimmages and things like that. But from a competitive standpoint with the numbers we have here for the fall, you know, it may be difficult to field competitive teams unless those numbers come up.
Matt, could you comment a little further about the DOE screening about using gymnasiums, that we have to get them approved, you know, submit a proposal and get them approved?
Yep. So through DPH, all schools in the state are required to submit a plan. For gym uses, any indoor sports, basically. So we're in the process of doing that now. After talking to our coaches, though, what I proposed was all of our sports, if we did have them for the fall, would take place outside. Soccer and cross country are outside as it is, but we would do volleyball as well outside. I know it's not ideal in the perfect scenario, but I do feel like it keeps our kids safer. We typically use our small gym, which is a very tight area as it is for volleyball. So I would just feel safer with having our girls outside if we did do volleyball. So with DPH, we use a different gym for our basketball games in the winter. We use Foley Hall, St. Matt's. So our proposal has that gym in place for winter sports. I would like to see, you know, as long as everything goes well here in the fall, us pick up with winter and spring sports. at the high school level at minimum. And we'll see what other schools in the state do as far as the middle school sports go. As of right now, there's still some schools that haven't made a decision, but it looks like from what I've seen across the board, there's no middle school sports being played. And the high schools that are playing sports are just doing varsity sports, what they call an expanded JV, where they may put more kids on their varsity teams instead of having a JV program, just to limit the numbers here for the fall because this all came together so quick. Ricardo, do you have anything to add to that?
No, not at this time. So maybe we can field questions.
I have a quick question. Sorry, Liz. Is there an opportunity for some of these sports, particularly JV sports, to have or to allow younger students to sort of be called up? I don't know how that works in our, I just think about when I was younger, eighth graders or seventh graders could run at a high school level if they were qualified. Have we thought about that?
Yep. So seventh graders, they're not allowed to participate at the high school level through the IAA. However, eighth graders can participate. We do need a waiver for that. That is a waiver that we've put in for. So we could technically bump eighth grade students up if need be, but you know, we got to consider we have a lot of kids in you know, our middle school, in particular the eighth grade. So that will bump those numbers up. I would think enough to get us to where we want to be for sports teams, but at the same time, having eighth graders competing at a varsity sport level, you know, is very rare.
Got it, thanks.
Any other questions?
A couple of questions. Could you remind me, are these the only sports that we have in the fall right now, typically?
Yes, these are the only DIA sports that we offer. We do typically have cheerleading. It starts a little bit later in the fall, but that is not a DIA sport, so that falls under a different category.
Now, DIAA and the state approved sports for middle school and high school, is that correct, or is it only high school?
Correct. All sports are approved, and then it was up to the schools, you know, superintendents, boards, what they wanted to do from there.
And there would be the same three sports?
Well, some schools offer other sports as well. I mean, football.
For us, I'm saying, for Odyssey.
Yep,
I mean.
Yep. So, yeah, soccer, volleyball, and cross country would be the three, you know, that we typically offer in the fall. So I would like to stay with them. And then the other thing we need to consider as well is Title IX. Sports need to be equitable. We can't offer, you know, two girls sports and one boy sports. So. How we're lined up right now, we would have two boys sports and two girls sports for the fall at the high school level.
So question, last year, did we have did we have high school and middle school teams in either of these, any of these categories?
Yep, we did. We
Matt, do we have waivers? Are we making families and the faculty, the coaches sign any waivers for participating in sports?
Was there another question there? I'm sorry, my internet just cut out.
Sorry, yeah. Are the families and the coaches signing any waivers of any sort?
That is something that we talked about. Ricardo, can you talk a little bit about where we are at with waivers for sports or a return to school? Is that something that we can legally do?
We can, you know, we can ask to have it done. Does it have, you know, the strength that we, you know, the coverage power that we believe it does? Council says not really. Jeff, would you add something to that?
Yeah, I was going to say I had this conversation with legal counsel, and they advised against it, that it could open things up in areas that we wouldn't want liability in the wrong way. Now, and to add what Ricardo said, generally speaking, a lot of times it wouldn't hold up in the court of law anyways.
In the court. Okay. Thank you.
And I did speak with other schools as well, just to see if they were doing a waiver or anything that were doing sports in the fall. And there was no schools that said that they were doing a waiver, to my knowledge.
Okay. And do we have any parameters as to, you know, if we start up sports, when, you know, at what point do we close them if needed?
I mean, well, you know, it's all going to be based off of safety. You know, DIA has their guidelines on, you know, when we can play, how many games we can play. It's still undecided if there's going to be any state tournament games, which I don't see happening here, at least for the fall season. But, you know, talking with administration, my biggest concern is, you know, we're getting close to flu season here. If I have, you know, one of my soccer players who starts showing, you know, flu symptoms or COVID symptoms, you know, is that whole team going to have to quarantine now for 2-3 days until we get results back? And if it's the flu, then, yeah, they can start back up. You know, if it's COVID, are these kids going to now have to quarantine for 2 weeks? So yeah. There's definitely a lot to consider here. There's a lot of obstacles. You know, it's a lot of changing parts here. But if it is something we do decide to do, we do have coaches lined up who are comfortable to work with our students here for the fall. And I think we have a pretty good plan in place to, you know, make things work and, you know, at least get these kids active and moving.
Okay. Thanks, Matt.
Just a couple of additional comments here. Part, you know, as Matt was indicating, and as we put in the charts, you know, it's a challenge to find officials. It's a challenge to find competitive matches as everybody is trying to navigate this. I think the other challenge that we have to keep in the back of our minds is equity. You know, we talk about sports, it serves a given population. There are other school activities, clubs, or programs that are not being ramped up, which other students would really like to be engaged in. And, you know, and so here we are, you know, pushing for sports, but we're not talking about other extracurricular activities that you know, would count to a curriculum of other students. You know, so there's also an equity aspect of it, not only in terms of who can participate or not participate. One of the equity discussions that occurred that I heard was, okay, who needs transportation? Who can get to games, et cetera? And, you know, we checked that. We looked at the number of students. We have the buses, should they be needed to assist with that. But there are equity, you know, equity components that have to be threaded through this conversation.
That's a good point, Ricardo. In the survey that we sent out, there was a section at the end for comment, and a lot of the comments and feedback we got were, you know, if we're going to offer sports, are we going to offer band? Are we going to offer color guard? You know, a lot of the other extracurriculars that we offer. So, you know, I do think if we offer sports, you know, we do have to consider offering these other extracurricular activities to be equitable.
Really quickly, I just wanted to make sure, I see some questions in the comments. Are we, I know the board got some of these materials last night, are we going to circulate or post this information for families and the rest of the community at some point in the next day or so?
Yes, I mean, there's going to be a decision made. The deck can definitely be posted in the reopening section on the website for if parents, you know, so parents that were not able to attend and families that were not able to attend, you know, can, you know, look at the material that is being presented tonight. And then based on the decisions that are the decision that will be made tonight, then of course, yes, we will be proceeding with communicating with our families and our students.
So Matt, can you just clarify a couple of things? So I know on the recommendations, you talk about conditioning and practice. How are we working competitive games with other schools in this initial foray into sports?
So we haven't done any scheduling yet. There's still schools that need games, so it's something that we could do. But, you know, circling back to what I said earlier, I do have concerns with where our current numbers are. The current guidelines, students have to wear masks at all times. So, you know, if you're playing in a soccer game and we have 12 kids on the team and they're running on the field the entire game with a mask on, you know, that's where it would be nice to have, you know, subs to rotate bodies in and things like that. So we do have the opportunity.
You're cutting out there, Matt.
Yeah, Matt, you're cutting out.
Think Matt? You'd be losing?
Yeah, we missed the part after you said we have the opportunity to.
I just want to make sure, Matt, can you hear us?
Yep, I got you guys.
Could you go back because you faded out?
Okay, so basically, yes, we can still schedule schools to play sports if that's the route we want to go. But my concern is just with where our numbers are for a safety standpoint. You know, putting 12 kids out there for a varsity soccer game is going to be challenging. And then the same thing with cross country. The only sport I'm comfortable with where our current numbers are is volleyball, and that was with 16 girls at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the numbers, but I think if we started up, not everybody responds to surveys. I think if they do get started, there probably will be a little more interest. Plus, you can pull up from eighth grade in some cases. So my consideration would be if we're actually going to try to do fall sports and kids are outside and they're scrimmaging and doing things, you know, why not have them look for opportunities to have competitive matches with other schools? As well as part of, a compressed season.
Right.
I don't see, I'm not sure if there's any risk in doing that if they're scrimmaging with themselves or playing a contest with another team. Is there any risk in terms of?
I mean, you have more exposure. You know, you don't necessarily know what the other schools are doing. You hope everybody's following the guidelines. But I would say the schools are doing things the right way. And if we did decide to do competitive sports, that's where I would suggest bringing up eighth graders and giving them the opportunity to try out as well so we could field these teams and have enough kids on them.
Okay.
Matt and Ricardo. Sorry, can I just – I know a lot of this conversation surrounding sports was initiated because of the reversal of the DIAA decision. Now, is there a similar organization that oversees, makes decisions for band and other things like that? Are there activities?
I'm not sure who that falls under. I know the DIAA, you know, they oversee athletics. They work closely with the DOE, but, you know, I'm not sure about extracurricular, they're separate.
If anything else, okay.
Yep.
All right, thank you.
No problem.
Do we have any more questions? Erin, you had mentioned that there were other questions, I think, that you were tracking.
It was more about, you know, we're discussing materials, but we're not sharing them on the screen, so folks were wanting to have access to the information that we're kind of talking through here. That was all.
Was it not up on the screen for a little bit?
Is it up right now?
No, was it up earlier?
I didn't see anything being shared.
I think they did share the PowerPoint. Helen, you're breaking up.
Good question. I saw JV, but what I saw from a lot of the other schools was that they were only varsity competitive sports. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
You broke up a little bit.
Hello?
Could you repeat the question?
So what I was asking was about, I saw that two of the categories said JV, but I know a lot of the other high schools are only doing varsity sports competitively. So are we considering that they be able to compete?
No, so what a lot of the schools are doing, they're doing what's called an expanded varsity team. So they are trying to do some JV games as well. And the reason we're at JV is we're at a two-year cycle in the state of Delaware for all of our sports. So what we do is we talk to our coaches, we evaluate our talent, we see where we're at, and then we make the decision, you know, are we going to bump up to varsity or not? So last year, it was our first year with a cross-country program, and then our volleyball program. Miss Grimes, who's a fantastic coach, thought it would be best for the girls to stay at JV. So that's why we're technically considered a JV program again this year. But like I said, you know, we were talking with Elias there, we will be able to field games. I'm confident in that. I've talked to enough athletic directors. We haven't put them up on the schedule yet because the decision hasn't been made. But, yeah, we can certainly play, you know, enough JV competition for our teams.
Just a quick question on the JV technicality. Are we JV also because in some cases we don't have a home field? In other words, for volleyball, we can't host a volleyball match or basketball game, so we are not allowed to have a varsity team. Is that true?
No, we can have a varsity program. That doesn't affect us there.
Okay. So we don't need to have a home field or home facilities to be a varsity team?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, and then the other question that I have, of these, so let's just say we say, okay, go ahead. Of these students whose parents have said, yes, that they want them to participate, do we know how many of them will need transportation to and from practice?
We do not have that data yet, no.
I don't think we even offer transportation after practices, at least practices for students. I know from games, away games we do. But most of them get picked up by their parents or classmates.
We do have a 5 p.m. bus that we typically run after practices, okay. Monday through Thursday. But they're just based on the amount of buses that we know that we have with our first student contract, we will be able to transport any kids that need it.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Ashley. So I guess barring any further comments, are you looking for a vote on authorizing starting up school sports?
We have a recommendation that was on that slide at this point in time in terms of conditioning and practices, you know, focusing on skill work, that everything be done outdoors, you know, that we continue monitoring the landscape and start planning. You had commented something about looking for some scrimmage games, you know, and Matt, I will defer to you if you think that's doable, you know, assuming that we can get officials, you know, and that we can find some scrimmage games or events for these sports.
Now, my recommendation is if we're going to be outside and doing the practicing, that we might as well do it competitively as well and look around and see if we can get on the schedule of some schools. And it'll probably be, I'm sure, an abbreviated season. Mm-hmm. But if we can have some cross-country meets and some soccer games. I know that volleyball is probably going to be indoors, but those have to be in approved facilities. So as long as we're okay with doing that at hosting sites and their indoor facilities are approved by the state for athletic events, I would suggest that we just go full athletics with games as well too. And it's three sports. It's small. Like I said, it's primarily outdoors, so the risk, I think, is low. And it aligns with some of the things we were talking about in terms of reopening and bringing students back for outdoor activities. So I think it's relatively safe from that perspective.
So is this just for fall, and we'll come back together to discuss winter and the plans there? Or what's the scope of the approval if we vote to move forward?
Me personally, I would like to see winter sports. As of right now, the DIA has them slated to start in November. There's not an official date yet. That may be pushed back a little bit now with fall sports starting late here. But I think if we're going to move forward with fall sports, then, you know, we should do the same with winter and spring. and then, you know, get a read on what schools are doing, if they decide to offer middle school sports, if they decide to offer JV and freshman sports, or if they just continue to do varsity sports. You know, we have a little bit more time to make that decision, but from my perspective, you know, I'm planning on moving forward with winter and spring sports.
I would just add one comment to that, Matt, that it's always subject to the trends.
Correct. Yep, yep.
The macro trends in terms of health and wellness, right?
Yeah, and I think the parameters also need to be outlined. Like, you know, if you have four students who are sick on a team, or locations of that.
Was that it?
I think he's just referring to safety protocols and health and wellness protocols for students, and how we manage that to make sure we have those in place if we're going to start any sports.
Yeah, I think just to add to that too, we have just piggyback off of the DPH, you know, protocols that we currently have. The school nurse would be notified. They would work with the liaison. They'd do an investigation and make a recommendation off of that.
Okay. Yeah. So, but for now, we're voting just on, you know, reopening, right? Reopening of the fall sports.
Can I ask
one? Or for the whole year.
Can we allow the decision of whether they're going to play competitively or stick with the conditioning and practices up to the coaches? I mean, if he doesn't have more than 12, why are we telling him that he has to go play competitively?
I agree.
What I'm saying is authorizing them to have competitive sports as opposed to just conditioning and practices. So authorizing competitive sports for the three sports listed. And I think we can come back and address winter sports, like Matt said, a month from now or something. Let's see how these things come out. But I think it's important. Like I said, this is a small group. We can test the water, see if anything happens with them as opposed to going into much larger sporting seasons with more students and then finding out that it's the wrong decision. And so I think this is a good way to at least kind of dip our toe in and see how well our protocols and processes are working.
Matt, can I ask you one more question? How many times a week do you guys practice? Sorry for being clueless.
I mean, anywhere from 4 to 5 days a week, typically, especially with our varsity programs, JV, we'd scale back maybe 3 times, but generally 4 to 5 times a week is what we like to do. You know, it all depends,
you know,
on the
sport. We are having the problem of equity with that, because you bring a group of students 4 or 5 times a week to school, and then others not at all.
And I agree with that, and I think we need to look very hard at these other activities where we can bring students together, particularly outdoors, or even in some way, shape, or form, these clubs or other activities where students can get together in a out-of-class setting, for example, to do things. I don't see why we're not looking at those, right? If we're not, we should be looking at those activities as well too, I think. And so maybe at the board meeting on the 21st, we can come back with a proposal to how that's going to take place.
So,
and I think, I'm sorry, Helen, go ahead. Go ahead, Helen.
So what I was going to say is, thank you, Marion. I guess my concern is, why can't we discuss that now? So I know at some of the other high schools, Ben falls under the same DIA rules as other sports. So marching band is typically something that does fall under the DIAA rules and protocol. So I would say, if we're going to have the discussion about opening these three, then at least let's have the discussion about band. I see one parent asking about band and color guard. They fall under those same rules and guidelines. So, I mean, if we're going to talk about activities at this point, I think we should talk about them now and give the same outline so that they all have the opportunity to be able to make this decision. And then whatever the parents decide as far as sending their children and allowing them to participate, we've already done that. And they don't have to wait a full another 3 weeks for us to make a decision on that.
No, that's a great point, Helen. And I guess Ricardo and Matt, if we basically approve a decision to authorize all DIA sports in the fall, whether we participate in them or not, and like Helen said, you know, things like band, that gives us the opportunity to kind of look at things like these other activities that we could start querying parents to see if there's interest in starting them up over the next few weeks. Are you guys okay with that as well too? Ricardo or Matt, I think you're saying yes or?
Yeah, I mean, I would be okay with it. I don't, you know, oversee those activities. So I guess Ricardo, that would be more or less a question for you, but I do know, you know, schools may say, hey, my, you know, marching band follows the DIA rules, but you know, that is separate from the DIA. And I do know, you know, Red Clay, that they are only offering sports. I don't believe they're offering any of their other extracurricular activities at the time.
You know, I think we need to broaden it beyond DIA, right? I think the whole notion is if we're saying it's okay, understanding you guys have done more work on the details of these sports, but if we're saying it's okay within a responsible framework for certain activities to come back, then we should also apply the same responsible framework to activities, whether they have anything to do with DIA, because there are some very worthy activities that don't touch
yes, it at all. And there are certainly some other activities that we've already started to bring back. So things like BPA and some other clubs have come back. I know that there are particular concerns when it comes to instruments. If Brittany is on, she can kind of give a little bit more on what that those concerns are, because I know that vocal music and instrumental music is also a concern for COVID.
This is Brittany Henning. I'm the school nurse, and I'm actually the COVID coordinator for Odyssey Charter School. Singing, instruments, things with forced air movement increase aerosolization of any particles that contain COVID, so they are actually not recommended at this point by the DOE.
Yeah, I'm not saying specifically. I'm just saying generally, let's, if we're going to say we're okay with folks developing responsible requirements for activities, let's say it for all. And if, and to your point, if there is no responsible way to do a certain activity because it's so dangerous, then you can't. But at least it opens up clubs and things like that that may be able to have social distancing and may have nothing, you know, very close together or anything like that. That's not DAA sanctioned.
And Brittany makes a great point too, but and I know one of the things that we're looking at that Ricardo put forward is an approval process for authorizing either activities inside the building. I don't know if it's outside the building, but I think a lot of these, particularly these types of activities like band, would fall into that category. And so they would have to run through a process where the administration and nursing and other health folks would have to approve that before it can go live. And so things like wind instruments could be an issue that may need to be addressed by the health staff. So I would assume that would fall under that approval policy. Is that your take, Ricardo? We haven't gotten to that yet, but.
We haven't gotten to that level of detail. I mean, we were thinking mostly of clubs and activities and one-off activities, but the point you make, I think, is very valid in the sense that we might not have a full band, but could we have a drummer's, you know, a drumming band or something like that in lieu of, you know, I think it opens up the creativity of new options, which can go through the protocol in the forms that have been shared with the board. I think following the protocol is critical, you know, so that all the potential resources that might be required in terms of the different operating departments are covered, you know, and then we can also, you know, through that process also assess if there are any cost implications that we need to dial in, should there be any. So yes, I would like to use these forms, you know, to vet these opportunities also.
So Ricardo, I just want to understand, are we extending, you know, the vote now to outdoor activities if they are approved, if they follow a certain protocol, and if they are approved, should be articulated that way?
That would provide school leadership with the greatest flexibility versus having to wait to come back to the board. I think in the form, you know, it's a 4-5 page form that the proponents of activities have to go through, to vet and approve and it first of all has to be approved by a school dean, even before the vetting protocols of the support and the nursing staff and operations. So that would give us the most flexibility, Marianne, versus having to come back.
Okay. And so I know those right. forms were designed primarily for academics, but maybe we can make one that's designed for extracurricular activities, and maybe they don't go through the deans, or maybe there's a different approval process. Maybe it's the health staff and yourself or someone in admin. I don't know what that is, but I think maybe there needs to be a separate form, unless you think going through the grade school deans is appropriate for extracurricular activities as well. Thoughts, Ricardo, on that? I know we're kind of working on the fly here.
I think a lot of people in this ecosystem right now, we're working on the fly in terms of putting plans together. Maybe what we can do is, give us a sense of latitude so that we can work on some plans with a commitment to report back on it at the next board meeting, and then we can course correct.
Okay. What I would recommend is probably two motions. One motion to approve all athletics and sports, full athletic and sports with competitive matches, and then a second motion to approve all extracurricular activities for approval based on authorization by the administration to execute those extracurricular activities and putting in place the proper protocols. And I think you have that particularly for the academic side, but at least you can start the process for gearing up for those extracurricular activities. And if you need us to approve a process for that, we can do that within the next 2-3 weeks, but at least you have the latitude to start looking for safe activities for students to get involved in.
Okay.
Any other comments or thoughts on this so we can?
Yeah, Ricardo, Elias, Rodrigo here. And you're suggesting this is for the rest of the academic year, or is just fall, or is there?
I think everything is approved on the caveat that we always have the authorization to stop if numbers get bad or things get bad. No one is saying we're going to do this irrespective of the conditions on the ground. If things are getting bad or COVID gets bad, or we might just have to shut everything down. So I think we reserve that right always, and even if the administration does as well too.
But
put in other words, if things don't get worse and continue as is, then the approval stands and will continue through winter and spring. There's no need to come back, right? That's what you're saying.
I think right now we're just approving fall sports.
Okay, so it's just fall?
I think so.
Right, because then in the winter the conditions change, then it becomes indoors. So we will have to rethink the numbers again. But is there a number, Matt, as far as you know, that like, let's say if it's over, right now it's 7.2%, if it's over 8, we stop them, or if it's over 10? Who draws the line?
I don't have a number from the DIA as far as sports go. So I'm not sure on that. I know they're monitoring this closely, but I don't think there's a number right now or a certain threshold that says once we hit this number, at least it's public knowledge to me, where everything gets shut down again.
I think we should approve it for the whole year and not just for the fall, because it takes a lot of time to gather all the data and everything. And I think if the athletic department, along with the administration, can come up with a protocol of, and pay attention to all those numbers along with the health committee. And I think we have to give them that amount of faith and trust them to make that judgment. Because I think it takes a lot of time to, and correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, to get all the teams together, gather all the data and everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a lengthy process, but like I said before, I'm planning on, you know, moving forward with our winter and spring sports because we do need to plan ahead of time for them. But, you know, if everything goes well with fall sports here, I can't really see a scenario where we would say as a school, fall sports went great. You know, now we're not going to do winter or spring. And, you know, if the numbers do increase and, you know, we run into issues and things like that, then, you know, we can meet in a month or so to discuss, you know, hey, we might need to have an alternate plan.
Oops.
So if the Health and Safety Committee works with the Athletic Committee and the Health and Safety Committee is okay, I'm okay with it. But if the Health and Safety Committee thinks the numbers are high, I have to go with their recommendation, whatever it would be.
Knowing we have a board meeting in a couple weeks, is it that big of a negative impact to say we approve fall sports today, go forward, plan for winter, and present to us what your plan and what the controls are in a couple weeks and let us make a decision on winter sports then?
Yeah, I mean, that's good with me.
Yeah, we can definitely work on that, Aaron.
When do winter sports start?
So there's not a set date. Originally, they were going to start middle of November. With things being shuffled here, the main priority for the DIA is fall sports. So I would anticipate late November, early December timeframe for winter sports. But that date has not been set yet by the DIA.
Is waiting till 21 October give you sufficient time to plan for winter sports?
Yep, definitely. And our schedule is already built out from last year, so a lot of the planning has already been done. But, you know, if we need to make changes, we can certainly do that. But, yeah, that gives us plenty of time to make changes if need be.
Okay. All right. So why don't we call for a motion? Does anybody have a motion on fall sports?
If I have to make a motion, I will make the motion to stick with what the coach is recommended and not push it to competitive level before we know if we have the numbers or whatever. So my motion is to go with whatever the recommendation is.
Do we have a second? Do we have another motion or a different motion?
Can I hear the recommendation again?
The recommendation is to go with fall sports, non-competitive fall sports.
Okay, and then we'll come back to the table.
Outdoor activities only, monitor landscape, conditioning and practices, focusing on skill work.
All right.
I would like to give the students the opportunity to scrimmage some schools too, you know, close to us. Now, whether that's, you know, different from being competitive or not, if there's not a state tournament, but you know, we would have the opportunity to scrimmage other schools, or we could just wipe that off the table completely. But, you know, the possibility of scrimmaging was in the plans.
I don't see it, in my opinion, and I know I differ with Eva on this, I don't see it as being different if they're out there practicing, scrimmaging with themselves, or scrimmaging or playing another team in soccer. My opinion is if we're going to approve it, we should let them play. Because they come to school to play competitively for sports, and so just
all I'm saying is leave it up to the coach. That's all I'm saying. We approve that they can do whatever, you know, the coach
approve the start of fall sports. Is that Matt? Does that sound okay to you?
Sounds good with me.
Okay,
I'm fine with it.
Second that. Do we have a motion?
Do you want to give us the motion again, Eva? Do you want to just motion to approve the start of
I motion with that we move, we go with a recommendation as it's been made to start fall sports for conditioning and practices, focusing on skill work, outdoors activities only, monitor the landscape, up to that.
Eva, does your motion include if coaches want a scrimmage, is that included?
Yes.
Okay, then I'll second that motion.
Can we have scrimmage or competitive games?
No, I'm not.
Yes, scrimmage, no competitive. I just want to make sure I understand exactly what the motion is.
Well, is there a difference between scrimmages and competitive games? I mean, if you're
we can stay here until tomorrow, you know. I will go for the scrimmages. No, I mean, I will leave it up to Matt. There I go. As far as I can go.
I guess my only concern with scrimmages is, period, just being around other students. If we have our safety protocols in place and we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, there's no guarantee that every school is going to follow that. So I guess I'm more concerned with our students being mixed in with other kids and families that may not be following those same safety protocols. Yes, I know it's a standard, but I was a high school teacher. I can tell you what doesn't happen. Directions don't always get followed. It does not just start from the children. It starts from it starts the apples. The parents don't always enforce it, so therefore the children aren't following it. I'm sorry. I don't agree. I don't agree that we mix our children with other children. I love the training idea, the strengthening. I think all that is awesome, but when you start bringing in other people, then we have an issue.
I need to listen to this.
All right, so we'll call again. We haven't had a second, so we'll call again for a motion for fall sports.
Can I ask one more question? I know we don't have a schedule, but are there even any games that have been scheduled that we could participate in, or to Helen's point, if we and Eva's point, if we say practice, scrimmage, is there anything we're missing out on, I guess is what I'm asking. Set aside the health question for a second, just purely from a sports question. Are there games and schedules other schools are putting together that we could participate in, or is that everyone sort of internally focused right now?
So you're asking from a competition standpoint,
is it even a thing right now? Yeah.
So other schools are playing. What's happening though is a lot of schools are staying within their district. Basically like what Helen was saying, a lot of schools don't feel comfortable, competing and playing against other schools. So the districts have, their set parameters. These are the guidelines they feel comfortable playing against those schools in the district. So we can still find games, yes. Like I said, I talked to other ADs who were interested in playing us. I just didn't commit yet because we didn't have, the green light from our school board yet for sports. So yes, it's a possibility to play games. There are schools that are doing it. There are some schools that have opted out of fall sports. But yes, it's possible to schedule other games.
All right, Eva, do you want to put your motion out there again with scrimmaging added to that?
Matt, let me ask you one last question, okay? So yes. if we now allow scrimmages or games, which I'm not comfortable with that, but we have the problem of you not having enough players for soccer, and B, volleyball being indoors and not outdoors. So the whole thing that we see proposed here would have to change, right?
Well, we would still hold our practices outdoors for volleyball.
But then the games would be indoors.
Yeah, approved by DPH or indoor facilities. And gyms are a lot bigger than
at what level
we have.
They're debating.
And so what Matt said is Department of Public Health has to approve the indoor facilities as being adequate or appropriate for hosting a sporting event. And I think right now there's only four or five in the state that have been approved for that.
Yeah, it's a very lengthy document, and the DPH isn't messing around with it. Like Elias just said, I believe a couple more schools got approved today, but majority of the schools in the state have not been approved for indoor sports yet.
So without putting our nurses to the spot here, I would like to ask their opinion. What do you think about playing sports indoors? Or what do you think about playing games?
I think sports indoors is going to be a whole new, because we're saying that people need to be masked when they're playing. So to play indoors, we're already increasing the heat factor if we don't have good ventilation. I think there's a lot of things that are going to need to be worked out, especially with volleyball. Cross country, absolutely. It's outdoors. Soccer is absolutely outdoors. to even say that it's low risk, I don't know if that's a reasonable statement.
So should we amend it? Sorry, Valerie. Did you want to go ahead, Valerie?
Thanks. I'll be brief. I think, I think Matt and Ricardo for really thinking some of this through. You know, thinking over the next couple of months, with we're going to be losing daylight each day, and I feel like, you know, this is one of the last opportunities that we can get kids outside. We can get them, you know, interacting outside of the home. If we can do so, to Eva's point and to Brittany's point, in a way that we can comport with all of the safety guidelines, I would be in favor of that. And as we were talking, I was thinking, and I see some parents have raised this point too, I would hate to put the school in a position where maybe we were, you know, over-enthusiastic on the sports piece, and then that led to, you know, some sort of outbreak or an additional infection that would prohibit us from bringing kids back into the classroom. So I guess I'm saying I would be in favor of authorizing fall sports to proceed, and would just ask, I think the board should be nimble in sort of reacting as we get additional data, as we see how things proceed. And I know the administration's being sort of embracing this problem with the same sort of flexibility. So I think if we can just continue keeping those things in mind, I'd be in favor of such a motion.
Or should we amend the motion to say that as long as activities are outdoors, you know,
how about if we amend the motion that we give the okay for fall sports for outdoors play, and if we want to add something to that, that Matt and the Health and Safety Committee should be in agreement.
So in other words,
so they can figure it out. We're giving them the okay to go with what's proposed here.
With what's proposed, with the latitude to adjust it based on the health staff and the athletic staff concurring.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with the parents that are saying, we have to start discussing, you know, the reopening of academics.
Okay. Can we just have the motion and then let us vote? Because I'm really not even sure what it is right now. So we can just, if you can put your motion back out there so we can see if it and just vote on it. Because I'm not sure, but I would like for us to get to the next part. I mean, a lot of parents are feeling this heat. So I think we do need to talk about what we're doing about reopening. Sports is a separate situation.
Right. So open the full sports as asked by them. Coach and Ricardo, subject to whatever protocols are established and monitoring by the Health and Safety Committee.
I'll second that.
Any discussion on that? And just to clarify, does that include scrimmage games, or those decisions by the coaches to include scrimmages?
No, I think it's anything outside of what the bullet points are.
Right. Okay, so anything beyond that, as long as they both agree to it, then they can do it.
And that includes the nursing staff, right? Just to be clear. Yeah.
Well, the Health and Wellness Committee.
I guess. Yeah, I just want to make sure I had it right. Okay, so if so just real quick, I just want to make sure I have it. So a coach wants to scrimmage against an outside school, the nurses say it's a bad idea, that doesn't happen, right? Is that yes? Yeah, that's nodding. Okay. Sorry, Les, I just wanted to make sure I had it.
So all in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
One opposed? No, the motion carries. I guess the next point we wanted to make was, do we want to make a motion for authorizing extracurricular activities based on the same type of criteria? approval by the administration and health committee.
Health and wellness.
Health and wellness. Do we want to put a motion on the table for that as well too?
I think we would, and I would so move, given the parameters that sort of govern the preceding motion, that we authorize extracurricular activities contingent upon how the administration continues to evaluate their safety and under the safety parameters we approved for going forward with sports.
I'll second it.
So that means the question, so that means it's out, as long as outdoor only as well, just like in the sports.
I think there's an approval process that I think the administration is going to bring forward next month to address extracurricular activities. Is that correct, Ricardo?
If we need to, we sure will.
But I think we're authorizing that those activities can start up based on proper okay from the administration, which includes the Health and Wellness Committee.
Well, there's that, and there's the gatekeeping of the detailed survey, questionnaire that everybody has to fill, that has to go through the gatekeeping process of all the departments, basically, all the support departments.
Certainly. So do you want to restate your motion, Valerie?
Yeah, I guess
I think you had it.
I'm not sure what I would change from what Ricardo said, other than just continuing to authorize the administration, giving them the flexibility to work with all of the relevant authorities to think about authorizing extracurricular activities, again, consistent with the Health and Safety Committee and anyone else at the school that would have an impact on this decision making. There was a comment earlier about if we allow sports, why not give kids a chance to participate in marching band and other extracurriculars? I think that's a great point. So the spirit of the motion is just to, you know, to apply what we just did with sports to the extracurricular setting and give the administration the leeway to do that.
Okay. Do we have a second for that motion?
I'll second it. Okay. It's Marianne.
Second it. Do we have any discussion on it? Anyone call for a vote? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so the motion carries unanimously. Thank you, everybody. Sorry, I know it was a long discussion, but it was the first foray into bringing students back to school in this environment in any formal way. And so I know it needed a lot of discussion and a lot of talking. So I just want to thank everybody for their patience as we go through this. I know there are a lot of other important things that we need to discuss. But thanks everybody for their time and patience in that. Ricardo, can I do a check with you on the auditing firm and where they are?
Elias, I think Tim Sawyer from Barbicane Thornton should be on the call. Tim, are you there?
I am here.
There you go.
All right. So I know we had reopening plans. How long, Tim, do you think it's going to be to go through the audit work?
I can make it nice and brief, maybe 5-10 minutes.
Okay. Let's do that so we can get Tim. Why don't we do the audit really quickly, and then we'll switch back to the reopening plan.
Tim, do you need screen share capability?
Yeah, that'd be great if we could do that, and I can put up the pages of the report I'm going to show everybody. Everybody see that?
Yep.
Okay. All right, I'm gonna start off with the, I'm here in the audit report. So the main thing here with the audit report is the opinion paragraph where we talk about whether or not the school's financial statements are fairly presented, in which we are going to issue an unmodified opinion or a clean audit opinion, meaning that they are fairly stated. I'm going to jump right into the statement of net position. And so I've highlighted a couple things here for you just to note. So you can see your cash was at 4.3 last year. It's at 3.7. And investments were at 3.7 or at 3.6. I'll talk about the decrease in those in a little bit. The main thing that we always like to point out, especially because these items are out of your control because they're at the state level, and they're the net pension liability and the net OPEB liability, or the other post-employment benefits liability. So the Government Accounting Standards Board requires you to put these on your financial statements, even though you really have no control over paying the liability. And like I said, the state is going to be the one who's going to pay this, whether it be pension benefits to retirees or the post-employment benefits or health insurance to retirees as they come due. But you can see here, we're at 5.3 on the pension, you're now at 7.7, and you were at 33.4 on the OPEB, and you're now up to $38.8 million. So quite a big swing. There's also a couple of deferred items that go along with this. So you have your deferred outflows of resources related to pension and OPEB, and they went from 14.9 to 22 million. And then on the deferred inflow side, we went from 4.9 to 8.6. So big swings in those liabilities that are based on actuarial valuations done for the state plans at their levels. So that effect that it had on you is you went from a deficit of 25.3 to a deficit of 30 million. And you can see if you're thinking, well, we've got a deficit of 30 million, but your pension and OPEB liabilities combined are 45 million. That's the sole reason you're in a deficit position, because of those liabilities that you can't change. The change in the current year is the deficit went from 25.3 to 30, so it went almost $4.8 million. It increased. And that is really because if we look at two items, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here. We look at the two items, the extra expenses that you picked up for the pension were $1.4 million and an extra $3.1 million on the OPEB side. So again, these two items here are really driving this $4.7 million loss in the current year. So it's basically kind of almost, I want to say, paper loss, in that you're picking up those extra expenses related to those liabilities that you don't control. Now, that being said, if we look at the fund level or the balance sheet accounts here, You have four funds: the general fund, debt service, there's a repair and replacement, and a supplemental reserve fund, and they make up all the total. And the total, your fund balance was 5.6 last year, it's at 4.3 this year. And the main reason for that, if we look over here, when we look at your expenditures, you can see we had 25 million in revenue last year. And 27.3 million this year. So your revenues are up, but your expenses also are up from 25.5 to 28.5. So overall, we had $1.3 million basically a loss this year at the fund level, taking your fund balance from 5.6 to 4.3. But a lot of that, you can see you had capital outlay. So you had $1.4 million worth of additional assets. And then, of course, your debt service are the big providers there. We were just talking about the assets. So if we look at the capital assets in your footnote, you can see the beginning balance, the additions to it here, and the decrease of the construction in progress. This just means it went into service. The construction was complete on one item. So you were at 36.1 in net assets, which are net of your depreciation, and 36.5 at the end of the year. And then the other big one to show you is your debt. So your debt, you've got 36.2 million in outstanding debt, 822 of that's due next year. And you can see we were at 37 million. We paid back 783,000 this year to bring you down to 36.2. And then here is the change in your OPEB and pension liabilities again. So OPEB went up 5.4 and the pension went up 2.4 from the year before to get to those numbers that we talked about a little while ago. And then again, just to show you again on the pension, so your proportion is 0.5% of the state plan. And that 0.5% relates to the $7.8 million liability that we pick up. Now the state plan is 85.41% funded, so it's down a little bit from the year before. So hopefully, depending maybe on markets and stuff, that might go up again next year, and then the liability can go down. And then on the OPEB plan, you're a little less, you're at 0.48% of the plan. But that 38.9 million is the 4.8%, and that's because it's only 4.89% funded. They basically, this is what they consider a pay-as-they-go plan. So as the benefits come due, the state funds the plan and then pays them. So there's the reason for the big swing there. And then the other thing just to show you is you also, because of your level of federal funds that come in through the state, I have to have a single audit. And I just wanted to point out, because last year we had a couple of findings related to capital asset records. And I'm glad to say, just to point out real quick, the findings no longer applicable because the recommendations were implemented. And we had one on construction project management as well. And we have also were able to clear that with the group that your administrative team and accounting team did this year. So there's no more findings related to the single audit. So that's great news for you guys. And that is the quick and dirty overview of your financial statements this year.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate that. Does anybody have any questions? I think you did a good job, Tim. I appreciate it. Thanks for kind of the quick highlight of all the major items in the report. I don't see any major issues in there based on your audit. Anybody else have any last minute comments or questions about that?
No, I think the explanation on the pension percentages and the OPEB percentages was really helpful. So thank you for that.
Sure.
I appreciate it. That clarified most of the questions that I had as well, too, which is where those changes were coming from.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess barring any comments, would vote to approve the audit findings. Can I have a motion for that?
I move, this is Rodrigo, I move to approve.
Can I have a second?
Aaron, I'll second.
Second. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So thank you. So the audit is audit findings are approved, and they're okay to send forward, Ricardo and Jeff.
Thank you. We will proceed to work with Tim to get a final version of this audit so it can be sent to the Department of Education by the October 1st deadline.
Okay. And thanks, Tim. And thanks to your team for the hard work and going through this and getting it done.
Sure, thank you. And just to let you know, too, we will send an electronic copy to DOE and the state for you, as well as send it to Jeff and Ricardo.
Thanks, Tim.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Everyone have a good night.
You too.
Thank you.
So I guess the last item up on the agenda, Ricardo, is kind of going through. So you had put together, just so I can understand it from my perspective, a plan and not necessarily an actual execution plan, but an overarching a perspective on how we could potentially open. Is that correct description of the strategy that you have laid out here?
Well, it's number one, no, the intent is not to come to the board today to ask for any approvals at this point in time. This is a straw perspective of turn my camera on here. Excuse me a minute. Okay. What we're presenting today is, a snapshot of the work that is ahead of us and the complexities that we have to deal with in being able to come back to the board at the, what we're proposing is to come back to the board at the October 21st board meeting with a detailed reopening strategy. We have to keep in mind that we've got several schools in one school, and each of these schools may have slightly different strategy considerations in terms of what a reopening schedule might look like. So what we're really looking for tonight is more of a directional sense of the work that is ahead of us, looking at the proposed timelines in terms of a reopening strategy within the context of the landscape, and primarily, thinking of the charter school landscape that we're working within, and then field, any questions. As we go through the presentation, I do want to just reemphasize that this, even this level of work was only possible because of the collaboration of many people on the ground. So as we did in the presentation had in the early in the spring with regards to a proposed reopening strategy, I will be pulling in and asking members of the senior leadership team, members of the health leadership team to chime in as part of, as part of this conversation, as part of this presentation, to provide the depth of a sense of the depth of the analysis that has been undertaken to date, and also some of the challenges that we have ahead of us as we go back to re-engaging more actively and more deeply the working groups.
Okay, so thanks, Ricardo. I just want to make a couple points before you get started on the briefing. So I know it's 7:45 already, and I do want to be mindful of people's times. This is a very important issue. And understanding that this is not a decision brief, I would ask that you kind of try and hit the high points of this as quickly as possible, maybe try and get through it in about 20 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can have a discussion on areas that we think we'd like to see maybe at the board meeting on the 21st that we think should be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
That you can come back with. And so I'd like to give you the floor, but just be mindful of the time as well. And so I know a tremendous amount of work has been going on in these committees. They've been meeting for months. There are literally dozens and dozens of faculty and staff members and teachers and administrators and parents that are involved in these committees that are helping to come up with a lot of the recommendations across the board. And I know this is kind of an accumulation of some of those. And so we do appreciate that. I do want to recognize the tremendous amount of work that everyone has put into a lot of the work behind the scenes here. This is literally probably thousands of hours worth of work that has gone into the reopening committee work. So I just want to thank everybody for that. I understand that this is a important set of decisions for the school. It's something that the parents are very eager to understand. I'm sure the faculty and staff and everybody is eager to understand. We don't want to move ahead too quickly, but we do want to move ahead smartly and safely for the benefit of the primary folks that we're looking for here, is the students and the staff at the school, so and the teachers. And so I know we're all eager to kind of get back to normal. We are in an abnormal environment, keeping that in mind. So I just want to put that out there. But thanks to everybody. And if you can kind of walk us through this, this summary overview, we can provide some commentary on what we think going forward from here. Thank you, Ricardo. And thanks to the team as well.
Absolutely. So I'm assuming everybody can see the screen. Is that correct?
Yes, we can.
We're seeing your whole desktop, Ricardo.
Okay. So just very quickly, you know, part of the analysis that we have done is really within the context of what we had presented originally, and then looking at, to some extent, district schools, but also our sister charter schools. If we recall, we started with a proposal that we would be in a virtual environment through the second marking period, end of January. What we will be looking at today and what we are going to look to pressure test is actually looking to slowly anticipate the reopening of the school. I'm not going to demur here on, you know, what the landscape is, but just to highlight the dates, you know, if you just quickly, the Newark Charter has postponed their hybrid reopening all the way to after Thanksgiving. So a lot of moving parts. Schools are revising their reopening plans in an active manner and course correcting based on how information is processed. You know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, we are committed to educating our students, absolutely. But we want to do it safely, especially as we bring them onto campus in a landscape that is changing on us. These, in terms of the health landscape, we're going into a season of flu meeting COVID, and that intersection is a big question mark that not only we have to, but the whole community, the country, the, you know, and the country has to deal with. And we want to be very, very mindful as we go through the opening. We've started virtual learning. We have the issuance of the activity approval forms done, you know, and hopefully over time, we will have a landing strip where we will have the school reopened fully, although not every, you know, not all students are going to be present. I want to come back to the gatekeeping criteria. These have served us well. We want to be very, very cognizant that number one, we want to be able to do this well in terms of health and safety of our students and our staff. If we can pass that test, then we go into the academic and equity gateway. You know, academic equity for students. We have staffing issues, as we had mentioned, as a result of the survey. You know, staff members that can come back, staff members that might not be able to come back. You know, how do we thread all of those variables so that we can bring our students back in a way that everybody has served in an equitable fashion? And of course, what are the related costs that have to be quantified and threaded through our budget? And finally, as we reopen, unlike, you know, the first phase analysis, the, you know, operating and service infrastructure, the costs related to that, you know, can be significant. So we have to analyze them at length. And candidly, I think that a number of other schools, although it might not be said, you know, we're looking at the price of ramping up operations, especially as charter schools, that does put a significant burden in the decision-making process.
Hey, so, Ricardo, you're not sharing the slides that you're on, just so you know. It's not
up. They're not being shared? I thought that they were.
So we can see the OCS reopening strategy, and like at the top there you go. Keep scrolling.
Oh, this you can see. Hold
that
on.
That is what we're seeing. Yes.
Okay, you're seeing the email. I thought you were seeing the. Hold on. Let me just try again. Let me see if this is. Is this, can you see this now that it's scrolling? Yes.
Yep, that's better.
Okay, thank you so much. So we've spoken about sports, you know, clubs and all of that. You know, I just want to focus on the academics and, you know, we can dive into that. You know, once again, I want to reference that the first mark, the second marking period that we talked about reopening at the end of January, what we're proposing is to slowly start reopening the school come November. We've got the month of October to do the robust plans for, you know, each of the layers of our schools. You know, different complexities that you will see as, you know, some of our leaders on the senior leadership team will comment with regards to the schedules. You know, we've talked sports, clubs, you know, the support activities, open timeline, those have been ongoing. Social activities are being pushed back on campus because, as we said, we want to reopen the school. One of the aspects that we started looking at is within those timelines, how do we reopen the school without putting too much weight on the population density on the campus in light of the COVID restrictions? How many students can we get in a classroom? How many students can we get on a bus? So this chart basically shows us that we are going to be managing having 15 to 30% of the student body on the campus on any given day. And we can see that under the total student count. Wednesdays, we would be closed for a deep clean. Now, we have challenges, of course. We just don't know where COVID-19 is going to go. These plans may be shot as we walk through the interface of COVID and flu season. You know, we've got grade demands, and we will talk a little more about that, with rotating schedules, and therefore classroom needs become more significant. Directional traffic flow. We've got Building 23 for the next couple of months that is under construction, and managing traffic flow with a section under construction is going to be a potential issue. And then making sure that we're offering equitable treatment to all our students. So with that said, I am going to pass the baton on to Stephanie, Ashley, and the senior leadership team on the educational side to walk us through what these potential schedules look like.
Good evening, everybody. I am going to speak very quickly to some sample schedules. Again, as Ricardo said, this is a very basic framework for us to have together in order to move forward with the planning process. So we are kind of looking at two different options, a full day and a half day. I'll start with the full day schedule. Ultimately, a full day schedule would allow students to be on campus for a full time period, as you can see. And this is primarily speaking for the K-5 grade band, so those primary homerooms that we have. So it would be essentially a full day, 8:15 to 3:15, with the cleaning worked in there. It is recommended from the governor and the guidelines given out that there are cohorts of students. So in order for this to be accomplished safely, we would have homerooms, which are comprised of approximately 23 students, broken up into two cohorts. So for example, if we have a kindergarten class with 23 students, they would be broken in half for students to come in cohort A, which would could potentially be a Monday, and cohort B, which would potentially come on Tuesday. So that would allow them to be on campus one full day per week. With that being said, there's a lot of different hurdles that come with creating these schedules. The number of students that will actually end up being on campus. We know we have families that will choose to keep their children remote. And at this time, I think... At this time, I think one thing we are striving for, I know other local districts have released that your child is not guaranteed their teacher. We are working really hard to ensure that our students remain with the current teachers that they have. So it's going to take a little bit more planning on our part, but in a world of uncertainty, we want to try and provide our students with as much certainty as possible. They have invested time and energy, as well as our staff have, to build relationships with the students they have in their classroom, even through a screen. So with a full day schedule, this is what it would look like. Again, it would be two cohorts. They would be on campus all day. This would impact the virtual setting, as students would need to be online all day while some students are in the classroom. And a number of questions come along with this, such as, you know, the streaming into the home, students zooming into the classroom. A lot of those logistics are to be worked out. Again, this is very preliminary and just to give people an idea of the options that we're looking at. With that being said, we'd be looking at, you know, a Monday, Tuesday, and a Thursday, Friday with a Wednesday cleaning day. And it would follow along with the breakdown that Ricardo had just mentioned on the previous slide. So if we scroll down to the next slide, which is a half day schedule, again, extremely tentative. This would follow the same exact schedule that we are doing in the virtual learning setting for the elementary grades. The 30-minute classes with a 15-minute break in between, and then students leaving at approximately 1:30 at the latest. We know that this option puts a lot of stress on our families for getting their children to and from school with the half-day schedule, as well as the potential for our bus ridership to increase because of the challenges with getting students to and from school. One thing that I do want to point out is working with the K-4-5 population. Again, we have those primary homerooms, so it's very easy for us to create cohorts for the students to remain in those cohorts as recommended from the governor. So both of these options present pros and cons, as with anything. The important thing is that we are working towards getting these students back on campus, and we'd like to, you know, start with our younger population with those easily assembled cohorts and stem from that point forward. So again, we're looking at the full day and a half day option, very tentative framework there. And then if we can just scroll down to that next slide. So there's a lot of considerations when doing these schedules. And like I said, we're working extremely hard from this point forward to ensure that our teachers are able to keep their same group of students, that students are not displaced and pushed into another classroom for whatever reason. So K through four, we have those primary homerooms. As I just said, it's a lot easier to ensure there's no intermixing of groups. So fifth grade kind of gets lumped into that middle school, but kind of still elementary school range. And as we increase in the grade level, it gets a little more difficult to create the cohorts due to leveling. There's usually at least one and sometimes two deviations from the grade level that students, the level of classes that they're taking, such as honors for ELA and math and the levels of Greek. We also have a number of teachers that teach in between grade levels, so you're not necessarily working with one grade level. Are cohorts possible at that point? Yes, but it would take some extensive work to essentially potentially reschedule some of those students at the middle school level, as well as, you know, working through the finding students that are paired together and making those cohorts. We did some preliminary measurements as far as what it looks like, knowing the number of students that we can have in a classroom. All classrooms are different sizes, different square footage, allowing for different students, numbers of students to be in there. So we're looking at roughly roughly 10 to 12 kids per classroom. Also keeping in mind that we are anticipating that we will have a number of families that also do choose to keep their child remote, even if we do go to a hybrid model. So I know I kind of went through that quickly, but I'm going to just turn it over to Ashley, the dean of the high school, to talk at a higher level as far as the high school goes.
Sure. Thank you, Stephanie. So I'm just, when we look at our reopening plans and looking at what it looks like in the middle and high school level, it certainly is more difficult once students get to those points of switching classes. At the high school level, it is even more difficult than it is at the middle school level. For example, there are 9 different levels of math class that a student could be placed into. And so at that high school level, knowing that we have 9 different levels of math, we also know that that means that there are 9 different cohorts there. We have lots of classes that have combined groups of students. So there might be 9th and 11th graders in the same class or 10th and 12th graders in the same class. So we are determining how we can make this happen for those students that do want to return to school and the classes where it is the most essential to come back. And so that is what we are focusing our efforts on at this time. And we are excited about the possibilities, but yes, still working through all those difficult issues.
Thank you. We've had the conversation around fall sports. And, you know, once again, the gatekeeping, the first gate that we always want to walk through is health and wellness. And we are engaging in some very challenging conversations around how do we measure when to turn on the switch of saying from a health and wellness perspective, when it's okay to come back to school. We get questions about quantifying these trigger points, but as we all know, the measuring sticks vary very often and sometimes considerably as we try to fix some of these measuring components. And so that's part of the conversation around the health and wellness. You know, so we look at the trends. I mean, we see that right now we're in yellow. We have of the different components, we have 2 that are in yellow, 1 that is in green. Although the trends, we believe that the trends that we see under new cases per 100,000. The trend is headed towards the red. The trend in terms of persons testing positive is also tending towards the red in the general picture. And the question mark is how long will this green, the average daily number of hospitalization, we believe that given the seasons that we're getting in, going to come into, that this will trend towards the yellow. This moves us from minimal to moderate to potentially being significant, which would require a scenario of then lockdown once again. You know, so with these statistics in mind, I am going to pass the baton on to...
I'm here, Ricardo.
Oh, sorry?
I said, Brittany, I'm here. Yeah. I can do the slide if you would like.
I want to pass it on to Brittany, who has been chairing all the work of the Health and Wellness Subcommittee.
Good evening. I'm Brittany Henning. I'm the nurse for 6th grade through 12th grade at Odyssey. We wanted some hard kind of guidance as far as what we're looking at for the data. Everyone says, we're going to look at the data, but what does that really mean? So we had some conversations around possibly looking at some kind of equation that would help guide our practice. So the new cases, the percent of persons testing positive, the average daily hospitalizations, and then that R factor. We would like to see those downward trending for a period of 2 weeks. So what does that mean? A downward trend, which should be within the 0.5% of the new cases, percent of person tested positive, the average daily hospitalizations, and that R factor. R factor is a snapshot day to day. It is not a rolling average. So we would probably look at it as more of a Monday through Monday or 2 day, a week full of the R factors, not just a single day, because it can change drastically. So what does that mean a little deeper? At 75 new cases per day with 1,950 students, that would be about 1.5 students testing positive a day. And with it down to 50, it would represent about one child or staff member positive a day. Well, actually, it's just children we're looking at in 1950. So again, we would work with the state DOE and the Department of Public Health to follow the guidelines and the recommendations that are mandated. We would also continue with our temperature screening. We'd involve families in health assessments prior to coming to school, and then kind of endorsing and making sure everyone is educated and has equity to thermometers or tools that are needed for those assessment pieces. We're going to continue to trace our probable positive cases or our true patients that have tested positive, and following them, coming in contact with who their contacts would be, and then following DPH's recommendations for testing. We currently have offered free testing to every staff member at Odyssey, but working on that protocol for what we go further with.
So thank you, Brittany. So when we look at the work that is ahead of us, the idea that we wanted to present to you tonight is basically a skeleton of the work that we propose to do through our three committees, plus the oversight committee, is pressure test these schedules. You know, we've shown a tentative schedule for, you know, the elementary school. We have to develop schedules for, you know, the middle school, the high school, given some of the constraints and some of the challenges that have been mentioned by both Stephanie and Ashley. And this is complex work, because then it will, it will also entail allocation of the physical space that needs to be made available. And of course, the larger the footprint that we need to make available in all the buildings, the greater the demands are with regards to the support staff to make sure that the buildings are kept cleansed every day, that they're cleansed every day, that they're clean, and that they're cleaned between you know, the transitions of students from class to class. So there's a cleaning process there. There are cleaning protocols for restrooms. There are windows of time that restrooms have to be kept clean. And so population density on campus is going to be a critical factor as we look at that, and the schedules are going to define that. You know, we do have to go back and look at faculty needs and staff needs. We had in our initial survey of staff, we had a significant number of staff in the different buildings not being available for health reasons. And so we're going to have to process that and see what the impact of that is on the classrooms and on the student body, so that we can ensure that there is equitable treatment for all classes. We don't want to have a section that is left to being able to only participate remotely because the teacher or teachers are not available for in-person teaching, and how do we address that issue? You know, so we do have this balancing act that we have to thread through together with the HR department, you know, to see exactly who will be able to be on campus as we ramp up the reopening efforts. We do also then have to thread through the virtual learning options for parents that Stephanie mentioned will choose to stay remote. And, you know, identification and quantification of the incremental costs across our operations, both on the academic side and then on the operating side. On this chart, you just see a sample calculation. Here,
what you see is a, you know, potential analysis that says that the monthly cost per, you know, the monthly cost of transportation services, you know, with, you know, a given number of students is $18,000. Now, we've assumed certain ridership factors that are historical ridership factors. We don't know what these factors will be as we reopen schools. So even these numbers are moving targets. And as John mentioned in one of our meetings, once we have these plans laid out from an academic side, they have to be pressure tested on the services working group to see exactly all the supports that are needed in terms of custodial services, in terms of PPE, food services, because the kids being back, we have to have the food services and the meals and the scheduling of those. And of course, the business office then has to reflect that in the recently approved budget. So it's likely that we will have different iterations of the budget. So in light of all of this, this is what we're proposing to the board. You know, based on this presentation, we would proceed with a community update after this presentation. We will work, the oversight committee and the working groups, based on these guidelines that we have presented, would dive into the nitty-gritty to develop the plans and the schedules as described here. We will go out once again to survey our families, you know, to better understand where they are landing, especially if they are interested in remote services and how do we thread those through while students are on campus. We've talked about the sports, you know, and then of course, from a health and wellness perspective, all of these plans may, you know, may turn on a dime depending on what the landscape is occurring in terms of COVID trends across the state and in the environment that we are operating. And the idea is that we have a formal reopening plan presentation to the board at the October board meeting on the 21st. Elias, back to you.
Thanks, Ricardo. I guess I'll open it up to the board members to see if they have any questions, clarifications for the team.
I have an initial question. I think there was mention in some of the recent newsletters, or maybe even before that, about getting, you know, very, very small cohorts back on campus in mid-October in some fashion. And I think this, from a date perspective, seems to be after that. So I just wanted to check in. Are we sort of abandoning that? Are we not doing anything in person until we get to this kind of half and half cohort in the sample schedules? Or what is the plan for on-campus instruction or experiences during the month of October?
Let me kick off an answer to that question, Erin. I think we, you know, ideally, yes. I mean, we are starting activities on campus. You know, we've talked about driver's ed. I mean, it's a very small cohort of students that are coming in. I mean, we're catching up from the from the past summer. And then we will start in this school year's program with regards to that. We're doing all the assessments for special education and ELL students. So there are activities that are ramping up. Now that we have the approval form, you know, this is going to be socialized to the organization for them to, you know, submit their requests for some of these activities. So my sense is that although I'm not ready to give you a definitive answer around the timing, I think we do have a good, you know, a good possibility that we will be seeing some of these activities starting up mid-October because we've got a two-week
approval window, given the fact that it has to go through, you know, the approval form has to go through all the departments and be blessed and reviewed by them. Does anybody else on the senior leadership team want to add to that?
So is it sort of up to specific teachers or, sorry, my kids are going to bed and they're not happy about it. Is it up to specific teachers or you know, folks who are leaders of programs to suggest or ask for sort of one-off on-campus activities in October? So it's not sort of an organized, you know, all kindergarten teachers are going to have four or five kids for an hour a week in the afternoons, but it's more like a one-off approach for October, and then it's more systematic versus, yeah, after that. Is that the right way to think about it?
In short, yes.
Okay. Any other questions from the board members? I had a question for you, Ricardo. So I know when we approved the initial virtual plan, we had also approved starting small groups, particularly special education. And folks that had challenges learning within 30 days of school start. Where are we with those plans and bringing in these small groups of particularly special education students to help support their needs?
Let me kick it off, you know, and then I will ask the deans to compliment. It's probably moving a little slower because we have both a new special education services manager in place that is ramping up, and an EL services coordinator, which has stepped into the new position. The first step that they are focusing on right now is making sure that all the assessments are conducted. You know, and that also is critical because there, you know, there is an associated funding, especially in the special education field, that we need to nail because we have to render services. And so it's very, very important that we, you know, make sure that the students are assessed correctly so that the state can provide us the appropriate funding that they provide for the level of service that may be required to those students. And we're going through that phase. I would have to get back to you with regards to more detail about other specific activities in terms of bringing students back to start the planned activities for them.
Do we have an estimated time frame for those students starting to come back? Are we looking at, because we're at about 30 days now, a little less than 30 days, but are we looking at first week of October, second week of October? Do we have any sight on that right now?
I personally don't right now. I would have to get back to the board with those data points.
Okay, thanks.
And I can email the board with that.
Sure, yeah, I think it's important to move out on that as quickly as possible while we're working this other planning in parallel.
Absolutely.
And number two, I guess my second question is related to, I guess, the upper schools. I know the lower schools tend to operate in cohorts, one class, all the kids move together. And I know that the middle and upper schools are changing classes and changing the mix of students and groups. And so I guess my question is, what is the biggest driver that is delaying implementation of some sort of, I guess, execution of bringing these kids back to school? Is it all about consistent cohorts and these students all being together and moving together and not intermingling? Because I know that's a recommendation it's not, I don't believe that it's a requirement, but it is a recommendation to, if you're having lunch, have lunch with the same students. If you're on the bus, sit in the same spot on the bus. So things where you're trying to keep things consistent and constant to avoid cross-contamination, I guess. But in terms of cohorts, I know it's extremely difficult in places like high school. You may have three grade levels in the class, and how do you move those kids around consistently? I know you talked about doing major modifications to schedules, but I would assume that it'd be tough to get consistent cohorts that move together throughout the school, even if you change schedules. So what are the, I guess, besides cohorts, what are the other major, I guess, sticking points to bringing middle and high schoolers back more quickly?
Stephanie, Ashley, could I ask you to step in on that one?
Sure. So part of the reason why we are, one of the things that is the biggest reason is we have staff members, and I believe it was somewhere in the range of between a quarter and a third of our staff that would be unable to return. And when we look at that at the high school level, if I have a teacher and just pick any of my teachers that are unable to return, that is a entire set of kids that are unable to get access to their curriculum. And unable to get access to their classes. So the staff members that are unable to return is a huge portion of it. It's different than in like the lower school, where if they were to be able to like have a teacher that stays online primarily and a teacher that stays in the classroom primarily, that's not an ideal situation either, but that's a little bit more doable because it is all the same content. Whereas we have people that are doing very specific content areas that if they are not able to be in person would be a major roadblock to being able to get everybody back to school.
And how would that be solved if we're losing or there's a large enough number of teachers or staff that can't report back for whatever reason? How do we get around that? Is that going to basically say we can't have high school or middle school because we just don't have the teachers?
I mean, what they're doing in some other districts is they are having the things that are like, I just saw a comment. So Red Clay is one example. They're doing a virtual academy where the students are no longer enrolled in classes at their actual school, and they are enrolled in courses that are generic and for anybody at a general grade level. That is not what we want to do. We want to keep students in their classes and with their own teachers. And so that is our biggest struggle right now, and trying to figure out how we can do everything while maintaining students' current schedules. Our scheduling process is extremely complex. We offer a large, like beyond large amount of classes for the amount of students that we serve. We have a lot of classes that are singletons, so there's only one of that section offered for the entire school year. And so that does make scheduling very difficult, but it also makes our student or our teachers very valuable in the positions in which they are teaching. And so if one or two teachers from a department weren't able to be there, then that would be Our struggle is where do we have those students go to access their curriculum if they are in person. So if it's a limited amount of people, we could perhaps have them in a separate area, still see other people, but that is going to be the major sticking point that we have to work through as we figure out how this will look and dive more into those details, because this was just an overview of like the basic idea, and we will have to dive into those details over the next month.
I have a couple, quick comments and just in terms of information to receive next time. I think if we're hoping to do a survey, I'm just scanning through the presentation, the week of the 5th, which is next week, I think in order to have any sort of survey that gives families enough information to make a real choice or make a real request or express a real opinion, we're probably gonna have to have a lot more detail than this on what it looks like. What does the hybrid look like? What does it look like if you choose to stay completely virtual, that sort of thing? And I guess in terms of information for us, when you come back next time, so thank you first of all. I understand this is a distillation of a lot of work and effort, so I appreciate that. I think on the K-4 schedule, when I look at it and I think about sort of two cohorts of lower school or even intermediate school, I think it will be very challenging having one teacher try to manage half of their class in person and, you know, effectively educate the other half of class at home. So I'll just say the parent of a kindergartner and a second grader, those teachers are doing an amazing job of being locked into their laptops and locked into their screens and switching from Hello Smart to Schoology to Jamboard to all of these other things at the same time as making sure students are looking and they're actually unmuting at times and they're calling on people and they're, you know, standing up if you're, you know, having them stand up or sit down or whatever it is. I would want a lot more information on how our teachers will be supported in terms of being able to effectively teach both in person and remote at the same time. And then how we'll manage and measure whether our kids are still learning in that experience where they're sort of receiving half of the attention.
So to kind of jump in there, Erin, obviously that those are a ton of questions that we have ourselves. Those schedules are extremely generic. That's not necessarily saying that that is what we are going with. We understand all aspects of it. So this was very much like a 20,000 foot view. And as far as like kind of how we would like to start looking in that direction, 100%, in order for us to have an accurate idea of the number of students looking to come back, we know that our families need to be well informed about what our intentions are. So for example, if we are plan like exactly what the plans are, so then that way they can make an informed decision and that will help continue to guide our instruction. So basic framework like this isn't going to allow anybody to make a decision that they feel most comfortable with. They're going to need those additional details. So that is totally coming as far as along with the parent survey. But then as far as the classroom goes and what it looks like, there's no one ideal way for this to all play out. I think we all understand that from many different aspects. And we are trying to ensure that we are keeping what is in the best interest for our students first and foremost, as well as our staff, to ensure that quality education is still occurring, as that is what Odyssey prides itself on. So we will continue to work through all of those aspects so that way we can make the best informed decision for our staff and students and push that out to our families so then they can have the choice for their own child. So all of that information is forthcoming. Those are definitely questions. We have a running list of questions that we need to go through and sort out and get clarity on in a lot of different areas. So that is what we are diligently working on at this point.
Sorry, go ahead, Erin. Go ahead, finish your thought.
Yeah, so thanks, Stephanie. That's helpful. I guess as we're talking to the community, I think the most important thing is to be really clear, right, and really honest with ourselves what we can and can't do. So I guess I would ask, do we really think we'll have enough details next week to do a survey that puts forth enough thoughts in a detailed way to let families make decisions, or do we think we need another week? Like, I would just encourage us, if we think we need another week to really be able to say, here's what we think is the best thing, how do you feel about it? Are you interested or not? I would encourage us to take that time rather than, and maybe you can do it next week. I don't know. It seems like there's still kind of a lot up in the air. So I'm just curious for thoughts on that.
I mean, if we're looking to do a preliminary and allow parents to have their voice in exactly what we're looking at, it'll give us a better idea. It might not be every single minute detail that is being delivered by the end of next week, but I think there is potential for us to have a comprehensive, more direct line of sight as far as what plan we are looking to deliver. And that's something that we have a meeting tomorrow. We'll continue to discuss and make sure that we relay that out to the greater community.
Okay, thanks, Steph.
Okay, I have a question. Will teachers be surveyed again, or are you depending, is there no need to survey them again? Are we depending only on the data that was sent out earlier this year? And will teachers have a choice in returning or not?
I'll field that one. Marianne, I don't think we know for sure yet, because I think the student population at where they're learning is going to drive what the needs are going to be for teachers in the classroom. So that's to be determined.
What about the survey, Jeff? Will a survey be sent out? Which part is to be determined? You know, is there going to be a survey sent out, or is it the part that, you know, what happens if teachers, or will teachers be given an option to return or not? Or are both of them to be determined?
Both. Again, I think it'll be driven by sort of where we're going with what the plans are and how many students we're planning on having on campus. From there, we pivot to what the staff needs are.
Okay. And I see another question on the chat box, which is also something that I was thinking too. But will teachers be included in the decision-making process of how to deliver instruction during this hybrid time? And if so, how are they going to be included?
So it is my understanding that in terms of the academic and equity working group, under the leadership of Jackie and Juliana, has been involving been pressure testing more broadly, the work on the ground that they are doing as part of, this effort. So I think the answer, Marianne, to your question is yes, within the scope of that work, that pressure testing will continue. I think the request that you put out, that you just raised is, how to thread another teacher survey to revalidate some of the information that was provided in the past, be it to HR, or in response to some of the more generic questions that may result from this planning, probably is going to be a very smart thing for us as leadership to do. At the end of the day, we can make some amazing plans, but if we don't have the staff on the ground to deliver them, and knowing the shortfall in the system for substitute teachers and all of that, we need to make sure that we can have the plans, and they have to be pressure tested vis-a-vis the staff that is going to be needed to deliver against those plans.
It may also help some people make up their minds on which way they would prefer to go, even as teachers or as parents, if we narrow down a little bit the guidelines. And for example, if we become a little bit more specific and we say, yes, when the numbers trend down, but what does that mean? Below the RT, a number below one? Or trend down from 125 to 110, let's say, because that may be trending down, but is it good enough for me to send my kid back to school? Or when the percentage right now we're at 7.2, are we talking about implementing these plans when the percentage is below 3, let's say? In New York City, they hit 3 and they are thinking of closing the schools, and we're at 7.2 and we are thinking reopening. So I'm not taking a position here. I'm just saying if we as a group narrow it down and allow everybody involved to make a decision whether they want to go with hybrid or stay with remote.
So if I hear you correctly, Eva, the idea is that as the team develops this work, that we provide a framework around the trigger points in terms of the statistics that we are following that would switch a decision, decision made by the school. Is that a fair summary?
Right, because then, I mean, we have the guidelines by the DOE, but they are awfully broad, right? And I think we have to narrow it down and have a specific, like, target. Okay, it's below that. Let's do step one. That's what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm.
Copy that. We will factor that into the discussions and the analysis for our for the next board presentation, Eva.
Thank you.
Sorry, I got kicked out.
Any other questions from board members or comments or thoughts for the administrative group as they go back to put together some plans?
I have one more. Has there been any thought to bringing back need-based families, as in, can we get in children where both parents are working, or I think, Elias, you already asked this before about special education, that sort of a thing.
I can tackle that. And so that was one of the things that we had spoken to doing, particularly not only at the lower grades, but also at the middle and high school grades as a virtual learning cafe. That would allow students to be able to still access their online coursework and maintain their ability to do those things, but in a supported environment where they're physically in the building, though they wouldn't be traveling from class to class, and they could then have a consistent cohort that would allow them to maintain that consistent cohort. For the lower school and intermediate school, something similar could potentially be worked out, but we're really looking to try to do the other plans that we kind of gave first, and then if there are other things that are needed, we'll kind of tackle that as needs arise.
Okay, thank you.
This may have already been covered, so forgive me if I'm bringing it up again, but just thinking, has there been any discussion or thought to, you know, the teachers that can return, bring them back into school to administer in-person learning, and then the teachers that may not be able to, you know, have them take the lead on virtual learning, or, you know, are we sort of not inclined to split up classes or split up grades in that way? Could someone just speak to that a little
bit
more?
So, I mean, it's not something that's completely ruled out, but we, as much as possible, would like to keep our students with their current teachers. So we're not saying that, no, we're not going to, you know, intermix kids and potentially have teachers that are teaching completely virtual. And those are things that we need to sort out on our end as far as the number of teachers that are coming at, that are able to come back, and the number of students that we're looking to come back, knowing that we, you know, have 23 kids in a class, there's potential that some classes could have a full 23 that are looking to come back, and other ones could have, you know, less than 10. So it's kind of a grab bag per se. But that isn't something that we have completely ruled out. However, as much as possible, and once we can get some more information as far as from our families with a more definitive plan, that will help us kind of make that decision moving forward on whether or not we have to move students. It's not the best thought in the world, but at the same time, I mean, we're working in a situation that is, you know, never really been tackled at this point. So we are open to those. That's not ruled out, but it's not the ideal plan.
Got it. Thank you.
Yep.
I just want to have some clarification. So I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. The schedules that were shared, the full day, half a day schedule, bringing students onto campus, that will, at this point, will happen only if the COVID numbers go down for 2 weeks, or is there a date that you're aiming for?
Right now, the plan is to reopen based on COVID probably like COVID numbers. We wouldn't want to reopen at the height of the pandemic.
Okay, thank you.
And Marianne, unfortunately, as you know, different people track these numbers, they're mm-hmm. a yo-yo. You know, so we could be making a decision one week and readying a recommendation, and the you know, in the next week, all the numbers may tank on us, and you know, and then we get whipsawed in terms of weekly decisions, which is part of the challenge. You know, even as we just look at the R factor, you know, where we were in the green, and then we moved to the top of the list in the country, and now we're scaling back again.
And I appreciate you guys tackling the complexity of it. As a follow-up question, so are you looking at the start date of possibly, you know, monitoring COVID numbers after January, or let's say, you know, we have a miracle and the numbers go down in November? You know, would we be bringing kids back in November, or do we just say, okay, we're going to start to think about bringing kids back only in January, and then, you know, we check the numbers then? You're on mute.
I think, Marianne, that the proposed timeline that we were looking at mm-hmm. precedes January.
Okay.
Right? If we look at the timeline, you know, we're talking November, you know, we've got planning through the month of October, and mm-hmm. then starting to, you know, at least class-wise, in early November, you know, to bring, so we're going to continue planning, because we do have to prepare these plans independently of when they're triggered.
Right.
So hopefully we can complete the plans and have them vetted and approved, you know, by the board, and the trends are favorable. Then we can start rolling out as per the proposed timeline.
Okay.
If not, then we extend the remote learning, the remote learning strategy, but we have the plans in place when you know, when all the trigger points line up.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Any other comments by board members?
And just so I understand, those trigger points would include the R factor, the safety metrics that I think Brittany discussed, and once those factors give us a certain data point, then we say, okay, great, ready to reopen, or no, we are not, we're going to be working remotely. Like, I'm just thinking about it, are we going to, in October, are we going to be able to give, you know, the parents some certainty as to, okay, here's where we are with COVID, we're gonna full steam ahead and try reopening, or at that point, are we still going to be in the planning phase? And I say that looking at this presentation, very appreciative and sort of in awe at all the work that went into it, because I can only imagine how complex this would be. But, you know, I also, you know, hear parents that I think are looking for, you know, some certainty at some point, where planning just has to turn into action. Mm-hmm. So if you could comment on that, that'd be helpful.
So from a strategic perspective, Val, yeah, I think everybody, number one, is committed to wanting to see schools reopening. And yes, the intent now is, having had this concept blessed by the board, we now have the framework to engage all the committees, the Academic and Equity Committee, to go back and massage and work in preparing what these schedules look like for a proposed reopening. And as we said, according to that schedule, of course, the older the kids, the easier it is to keep them in a virtual environment, especially as, you know, and so when we look at the reopening, there was an intentional scheduling of the grade levels that we would be bringing back. So the idea is, yes, to get to the meat and potatoes so that we can start reopening, barring the world falling apart on us, because of COVID intersecting with flu season. But independently of that, what I would like to see us as a school leadership accomplish is have the plan formulated so that we are ready to implement it instead of having to go into another planning cycle once the colors turn yellow towards green versus yellow towards red. Because right now, we're all thinking that the yellow is probably going to head towards the red more than turning towards the green. That is not going to stop us in terms of completing the planning work that we're looking to do in the next 30 days.
Thanks, Ricardo.
So I had a couple of comments. I know you kind of have just quickly, because I know I do want to try and end by 9 o'clock, but a couple of things. So I know you have a staggered start in your planning for academics, like K to 5, K to 8, K to 12. I think if the conditions are right, every school should be working towards a plan to immediately bring students back to school when the conditions are right. Right. For example, on November 9th, the conditions are right, then everybody should be ready to bring students back and not wait until January to bring back high schools. And I understand that they're older and they can manage going virtually, but there's a major emotional aspect with the kids and the students in terms of being virtual. You have kids like seniors who by January have pretty much finished up everything that's important as part of their senior year in terms of planning for college, you know, taking all these things that are really important to them where they need some guidance and support from the staff. I'm sure they're getting it virtually. But I think being in school with their peers is important. I think being in school with their peers is important for all the kids across all the grade levels, particularly for the youngest and the oldest. And so while the oldest can manage it better, I think we need to be planning on looking at second grading period. What if we need to bring them back second grading period, right? Not third grading period or second semester. So I think those plans need to be, we need to have the best plans possible. I know the transportation is an issue in a lot of cases. I don't want to have that being a long pole in the tent. If there are, I think we can figure out creative ways to transport students in, whether it's carpooling or families getting together to do something. But in terms of the planning, I think everyone needs to come to the table at the board meeting next month with a plan for how to immediately bring students back to school across all the grade levels when the conditions are right.
We will add it to the list of challenges to frame out for the board.
Thanks. No, and like everybody said, I appreciate the work everybody's putting in on this. I know it's Herculean with trying to run the school and, by the way, make up alternative plans to teaching. The other point I wanted to make, and I know that Ashley made a point about there's a number of teachers that may or may not be able to come back. And so I think that physically students getting together in classes from an emotional perspective, I think is important. And so while I don't necessarily, I'm not a proponent of it, the question is, if needed, can teachers virtually teach from home with kids in class? The opposite of a teacher being in class with kids virtually at home learning. And so if we need to, and there are certain teachers that maybe have medical conditions or other reasons why they just can't be in school, can they teach virtually to kids in class and kids at home? And maybe there's somebody in the classes that are monitoring the students while they're there. It's an option to think about. So don't discount the fact that if we don't have all the teachers in, that we can't run the school. We can't have the kids in there.
And one more thing that I would recommend, Ricardo, would be if conditions continue to be, let's say, as they are now, or they were a month ago or 2 months ago, I think we also have to give a very realistic picture to the parents, what school will be like when the kids come back. Are they gonna be able to go to recess? Are they gonna be able to have lunch with their friends? Are they gonna be able to hold hands or, you know, talk to their friends? I mean, I think people have the idea that school is gonna be reopened, it's gonna be like last year. And it's not going to be like that. Today, we were talking in the Health and Safety Committee about having a bare classroom, not even bookshelves, not even anything else, because they can contain virus. I mean, you cannot clean them properly is what I'm saying. So I think we have to be also giving that realistic picture to the families.
I think that's right, Eva. I mean, I think like there are a ton of options and a ton of different possibilities, but I think we need to be ruthlessly pragmatic. Like, what are the things that we absolutely have to know? And what are the details that parents and families and teachers and staff need to know to understand what that world looks like? And I think we just have to narrow the box of here's what's possible. And even if it's not great, just tell us, what is it? What does it look like? In the end of the day, I mean, there may be some parents who right now at kindergarten, I'd love to have them in school, but maybe after you understand what it looks like, maybe you decide not to. But I think it's just really, really focused, laser focused on what are the things you absolutely have to figure out, and we communicate them out, and we go from there. We let people make decisions, informed decisions.
Yeah, I'd second that.
And Erin, part of the challenge that you're alluding to is that you can look at this picture and, you know, just like a prism, you look at it and the white light breaks out into 6 or 10 different shades of color. And yes, we have to make some tough choices with regards to saying we can't analyze 8 different possibilities because of the complexities. We're going to have to narrow them down and make a choice from a school leadership perspective and then present them to the board. And if they don't pass the board test, then we have to go back to the drawing board. But we do have to focus.
Prism doesn't work here. I agree.
We do have to focus.
And one last comment. It'd be nice if there were more than one option on the table as opposed to here's the only option. Now, I know you'll probably be exploring a lot of options. Don't be afraid to put them out there, because the reality is that you will not come up with a perfect solution for doing any of these things, right? There won't be one for a long time. And so all of these solutions are going to be imperfect. They're going to have flaws. They're going to have some level of risk associated with them. I mean, there's risk going to the supermarket every day to pick up your groceries. 20 people touch the items that you're grabbing on the shelves every day that you put into your cart, right? Or the stock clerks that bag your items. There's a lot of people touching things that you touch. And so we're never going to have a perfect solution to this, but we need to come forward with the safest possible and the best solutions that we can to make sure our kids are safe, make sure the students are safe, the teachers are safe, and the staff is safe to the best degree that we can, because we do need to educate these kids. And we do, I think everybody understands that while virtual is okay, it's not, they're not getting the same quality education that they would be in class, from a number of dimensions, both from an educational perspective, from an emotional perspective, a growth perspective. So there's a lot of things that we're losing by having them virtually. While it's doing an okay job, I think we are losing a lot of things that we can't even count right now and we can't even see right now, but we'll understand as time comes along. But and my push isn't to get them in unsafe conditions, but my push is to get them to school in a safe condition as quickly as we can, and understanding that if we need to shut it down, we shut it down, right? And we need to back off. So that's always on the table. But I do appreciate everyone's work, but I just want to make sure that there isn't going to be a perfect solution. So come to us with the best options that we have, and we'll look at them and we'll discuss them and we'll collectively come to a decision.
Understood, Elias. I think you've heard it from the leadership. Everybody is totally committed about wanting to find the solution to bring our students back in an equitable fashion. So that everybody gets the same or similar levels of service. And it could be tempting to focus on students or a school that might be easier to bring back and not make sure that we're bringing back everybody equitably. But yes, we will do as you're suggesting and requesting.
Okay, so and I know we talked about comments, but I think we've kind of relayed a lot of the comments in the chat section as well today. So I guess unless anybody has any final comments or major points that they want to bring up, I'll leave the floor open for a few minutes to see if anybody has anything that they want to say in closing.
thank you for putting all of this together. It is not an easy task what you guys are entrusted with.
Agreed. Thanks, everyone. Really appreciate all of the thought and debate and planning and hard work and questions.
Thank you. And we are saving a copy of the chats. Just want to give a line of sight to everybody that we are saving a copy of the chat so we can data mine it, especially with regards to questions that currently may have not been answered. We will look through them and make sure that we try to address as many of them as possible in a timely fashion. Some may have to wait. Others may be answerable sooner because they might not need planning work to be answered. But we are saving the chat and the comments and questions.
All right, thanks, Ricardo. And thanks, everybody. I know this was a long night, a lot longer than we had expected, but I think a lot of good conversation out of this. There'll be more conversation in a few weeks on the 21st when we meet again. So a lot of planning to do between now and then. And just remember, it's like everybody's here to help. I think don't forget the parents and the rest of the staff as well, too, that can be part of the solutions to help us get to where we need to go. And so we can rely on them as well to help. And I'm sure a lot of them are willing to step forward to help in any ways that we can moving forward in this process. So thanks, everybody. And I guess, Ricardo, any closing comments before we adjourn?
I would just like to thank the team as usual, for the Herculean work that they're doing, A, in the classrooms, be they when they're here at school or working remotely, and my personal appreciation to the leadership team that is helping me navigate, together this phase of transition while we wait for a new head of school.
One more thing, Ricardo, all the questions that were in the chat, I know you're saving them. Could they be uploaded into the frequently asked questions section of the website? So you can choose some of the questions and answer them on there so that they're more easily accessible.
No, absolutely. We can definitely contemplate that.
Thank you.
All right, thanks everybody. So I guess barring any other comments, we'll adjourn. It's 8:58. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
I so move. This is Aaron.
Aaron, do we have a second?
I second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion carries. Thank you all, and have a good night. Appreciate you taking the time.
Good night, everyone. Thank you.